Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Allison Downham Moore, Associate Dean of Research at the School of Humanities and Communication Arts and Associate Professor of History and Medical Humanities at Western Sydney University, to talk about her recent book, The French Invention of Menopause and the Medicalization of Women's Aging, which was out in 2022 with Oxford University Press. Hello, Allison. How are you today?
Terrific. We're really good. Thanks, Jane. I'm Yana. I'm just, starting my work day in the Blue Mountains in New South Wales, Australia.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, listeners, this is kind of an interesting, we're doing this over multiple days because Allison's in Australia, so it's the morning, and I'm in Europe, so it's my night. Different days, and we're like, and also I'm living in what passes for winter in this global warming world, and you are in summer. It's very funny. It demonstrates kind of just the big, beautiful construction of our planet. You know, planets are weird. That's what we've got. That's cool. All right, let's get to it. Okay. So, Allison, you're the author of a good deal of work on sexuality, particularly in conversation with gender, aging, medicine, the history of medicine in general. So this work's right up your wheelhouse. I see how you kind of like how this could have been in your frame. But I'm curious how you came to write about menopause and specifically kind of this moment when menopause begins to have a name.
Yeah, well, I definitely didn't plan to. So it was kind of an accidental book, you might say. So in about 2018, came to the idea that it would be interesting to bring my sexuality expertise to the topic of aging, because I was thinking about the aging of populations, the higher number of older people in societies. And I thought this is maybe a kind of topical thing. And I couldn't find a great deal of historical research on that intersection. And I thought the French context is pretty curious. I knew that there was a big growth of gerontological literature in a few European cultures of the 18th and 19th century. So I thought, well, that might be a good place to start. And so I thought, aging, what kind of keywords would I use? And I was using quite a few, and menopause was one of them. And that was a really big hit, you might say, is a keyword. And I found a huge number of French texts talking about la menopause. And then I realized they had a few terms for this life period as well. So then I was using some of those to search through texts and looking at what other people were citing, you know, the usual way that you kind of work out what is the important material when you begin a project. And it became pretty clear to me within a few months that there was a very large source corpus that didn't appear to have been understood by any of the existing scholarship. So I found some very excellent French historical work on the history of French menopause, but usually all of them using just a few texts as examples. and each one of them using different texts. So it was pretty clear that I kind of needed to establish how large was the source corpus. How many people were writing about menopause in the 1970s? You know, it seemed like from our current discourses, you hear this idea that menopause is taboo, that we are only just getting to, you know, the point where medicine is acknowledging that women go through this life change and might need different types of medical support. Well, the French were very aware of menopause in the 19th century, and so I was very interested in why was it such a big topic for them, and how is it we don't have any knowledge of this now? Like, how did that whole fascination get forgotten? And so that was kind of how it did. But I thought that might be a later book, to be honest. So I was working on a project about how Western biomedicine had kind of bifurcated the sexes in relation to aging. And so menopause was part of it, but I was thinking about men's aging, and I was thinking about all of the different terms used through the early modern period in the 18th century to describe life changes, crises, and the concept of climacteric moments. So the book was more focused on that initially. And then COVID happened. And all of my travel plans had to change. And so I was living in Germany at the time and on a research fellowship in at the Hansa Wissenschaft College in the north of Germany. And we went into lockdown. And I had to think about what I would do once it was clear that this was not going to be a few weeks. This was going to be, yeah. Even at that time, I thought maybe a few months, not years. So I rearranged my research plans, cancelling all the travel to different libraries and archives, and decided to just focus on the French material and see if I could complete that book. And that was a great decision because, as it turned out, I was in lockdown for several years, and I was able to keep gathering that material for several reasons. First of all, I had just found a whole lot of it before the lockdown, so I'd made trips to France and collecting materials, and then the library in particular, the Bibliothèque Interuniversitaire de Santé. Which is the French Health Library, they have now a very excellent digitization service. Mm-hmm. So I would find things in their catalog and order them, and they would scan them for me at very low cost. It was fantastic. They were incredibly helpful.
Oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the way we do our work now is so different even though we started, mm-hmm. you know. The amount of material I can access from my living room, which is great and sad.
Yes, yeah, it's both very exciting and incredibly scary. So where does it stop? It just doesn't.
Yeah, no, yeah. But one of the things you talk about really early on is kind of like there's a great amount of this a huge hit, right? Everyone's talking about menopause, but actually much, much later than we assumed, right? One of the things that I was very surprised to learn with this book is that the early modern people don't seem to have an idea of la menopause.
Yeah, I guess I had other people have been quite determined to find menopause in the early modern period. And I sort of looked very carefully at their evidence and what their sort of understanding of what they were categorizing as menopause. And I realized, oh, no, I think there was a little bit of a misunderstanding. So I think sometimes when historians have gone looking for menopause, they've been thinking, did past cultures know that women ceased to menstruate and their conceptive capacity stopped? So that was the question they were trying to answer. And if you ask that question, the answer is, yes, of course they did. This was very well known even to Hippocrates, you know, the Hippocratic period, Galen. Like this is it's known across a lot of different cultures. This is not particularly modern Western. But if you ask the question, did past cultures have a whole symptomatology of menopause, did they think it needed to be treated? That's a different kind of question. That was my primary question. And so I spent a lot more time with early modern sources than I expected to, because at the point where I decided the claim that there was an early modern menopause wasn't right, I thought, I'm going to need to establish this pretty seriously. you can't just say, no, you're wrong, and then only provide, you know, a few bits of evidence. So that was basically a whole year just dealing with that problem before I got on with the rest of the book. But I'm really glad that I did do that. And I also did have help from once I came back to Australia and I'd finished all of that work. I also had some funding left with my grant to hire a research assistant who had extremely good Latin. Mm-hmm. And I just asked her to look over these sources I'd identified and make sure I was understanding them correctly, because my Latin isn't amazing. I take a long time to plod through and I never studied Latin formally. It's something I've just had to learn as an adult to be able to deal with historical sources. But somebody who was actually trained in proper language programs with it is better than I at understanding it.
Yeah, that helps. It's still kind of a mess, though. no one's really good at, especially medieval Latin, when it's just a hodgepodge of things. But not the argument, not the point. I would like a little bit more kind of clarity on this idea that obviously people in history aren't stupid. They can tell, they know that there is a cessation of menses, but there's not an idea of the menopause. Like how do we make sense of that? What does that mean to us?
Yeah, look, I mean, I came at it, I guess. So when I first began working on this project about gender and aging, one of the things I did was read quite a lot of anthropological research. So I was thinking from the get-go, I was thinking, well, how do other cultures deal with this? And is there scholarship telling us, you know, how women age and what their attitudes are in different cultures? And the answer to that is yes, there's quite a large corpus of anthropological research on this question. And all of it is more or less pointing to a diversity of understandings of how we age. And in particular, a very important book by Margaret Locke on the Japanese concept of women's aging identified that this is changing, of course, because of globalization. So that's another thing we can talk about. Menopause is now globalizing. But the Japanese women that she interviewed in the 1990s, 1980s, had a very different account of their aging and talked more about things like being cold and having shoulder pain, not seeing it as a thing that required medical treatment, not talking about hot flushes, right, which is the classic symptom that emerges in the European context. And so that's kind of an interesting example of, like, well, this is a very, this is an industrialized modern country. We could probably think there are similar sort of effects on our bodies, maybe in cultures across Asia and Europe. But then, you know, there are some important differences as well. So I was thinking, well, okay, so there we don't have a universal menopause syndrome, if you like. Like, that's not how it presents everywhere in the world. So why might it be appearing in the European context at this moment? And I thought about that in a genuinely open terms. It's not just, it might be to do with a specific kind of what you might call a path dependency of how medicine emerges and the sort of things it's interested in. Or it might be to do with changing bodily life ways, because this is a period where greater numbers of people are becoming more sedentary. We have all kinds of foods entering European markets that are, you might say, processed. So this is the moment of the appearance of pastries and sweets. We have the development of the rail system that means the circulation of alcoholic products at a level that's never been seen before. So the 19th century is very significant for the life ways of Europeans. So there are lots of things that change in the way people are living with their bodies in this period. So I was thinking very much about these sort of questions in the beginning too.
Yeah, and the 19th century is our moment. So something massive changes in the 19th century. There's this explosion of discussion of menopause and a lot of writing about it. So there's this life ways changes, which is very interesting to think about, this European diet that changes considerably. And we talk about globalization now, but really, 19th century Europe is a period of massive, like, difference, a new level of globalization as well. Mm-hmm. So what else happens? I mean, this is, we have kind of perhaps changing bodies, but that's certainly not enough to explain why all of a sudden there's a discussion of this thing that everyone has seen for hundreds of years. What else is happening?
Yeah, well, quite a few things. I guess you could say I identified some two important lineages that meet at the very end of the 18th century that produce this explosion of literature. And one of them is more or less through the Paris School of Medicine, the other through the Montpellier School of Medicine. But both of those schools were also quite influenced by another medical school in Germany, that in Halle. And so I did trace an important lineage to the early 18th century development there of a larger number of texts focusing on aging and focusing on women's reproductive and menstrual disorders that more or less brought these kind of two interests together. So we see studies of menstruation in the Halle context that refer to older women for the first time as belonging in this concern of the sort of things that can go, symptoms that can occur to women in relation to their reproductive systems, you might say. So that's broadly the field of interest of the Halle School. And so the older women start appearing in those texts, which are mostly not focused on them, but they're in there.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
So I think that's a really important development, and certainly the Montpellier School was very connected to Halle. So the major figures in that conglomerate, Stahl and Hoffmann, they were of great interest to some of the major doctors in the Montpellier tradition. And the Paris School were very influenced by the Montpellier School as well. So there are lots of connections between these three faculties. But really, the menopause kind of gets nailed out. The foundations of it start to appear through the nexus of those three schools. And then I'd say it's Montpellier and Paris kind of fighting it out to claim this new invented term that appears in the early 19th century. And it became a very important topic for assignment to medical students to write their thesis on. So this is one of the reasons why I picked it up so easily searching the French National Library catalogue, because they have all of the medical theses in there. And
this is an interesting way to be able to observe a moment, right? An historical moment, as medical students are now writing theses about it. Okay, what is that? But what does that mean? What has happened that medical students are writing theses about it? Why?
No, I asked that question too. I thought, well, what is a thesis? It's a training exercise, so it's important to think. Well, why was menopause something that doctors, medical professors wanted to teach their students? And then I looked at the sort of arguments they made about the term and why it was important. And the thesis will tell you this, right? That's one of their tasks, is to explain why this topic matters. And what they said is, in many of them, that the concept that a new idea of menopause is a proper scientific term to describe something which has previously been viewed in hysterical ways, in catastrophic ways, as a terrible thing that happens to women. This is not true. So they made up this idea that the past had made a big deal about women's crisis of aging, their climacteric moment. They said that was how the past viewed things. And we're being sensible. We're saying, no, it's not a disease. It's not a crisis. It's just a normal life change that you must manage in a whole bunch of different ways.
So this isn't an illness. Even though we're now going to talk about it in medical terms.
Right.
But it has to be managed through medical care. okay.
You can see why this is confusing, right? I mean, if you just take them at face value, you'd think, oh, okay, right. So menopause is just a very sensible reduction of anxiety about something that people previously worried about. They did not worry about it previously. They worried about it from this moment onwards because doctors were telling them they needed to.
Okay, so what happens? So there's this crisis before, but now we're going to handle it. Like, let's talk about medical care. What can happen? I mean, this is part of a much larger kind of trend in writing about things, right? What we call medicalization. Mm-hmm. So explain medicalization and how how menopause falls into the category of this.
Yeah. There's different ways of using that word. So, you know, you have a lot of if you Google medicalization, mostly the scholarship you'll identify will be sociological critiques of medicine, in which people make the argument that there are things being subject to medical attention that shouldn't be. So I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting view of menopause, and that, you know, that's a legitimate argument that you could make about menopause, that maybe we shouldn't worry about and we should just get on with living our lives. But that's not exactly my concern as a historian, right? So I'm more interested in how things that were not previously understood to be medical problems come to become so. So medicalization to me is just a historical process in which more things get kind of absorbed into medical concern. And why do they do so? And what are the implications, and how do those ideas about treatment evolve, and why do different categories of disease matter to medicine? So those were the questions I was asking about menopause. And I thought medicalization does accurately describe this absorption of new categories of experience. But then I felt like I had to be careful to say, I'm not saying you shouldn't have a concept of menopause. Go knock yourself out. If it's helpful, if people find it helps them, then great. That's not a problem. I'm just very interested in how it came to be this concern.
Right. So there's this process wherein things are being many topics are being discussed in a medical frame. And what's the tie-in with gender? Like, it's because medical professionals replace other voices in the care of older women.
Yeah. So there was a huge literature, you might say, emerging in the 19th century on women generally, and that was a slow burn. So you might say there's been a kind of interest in women's medicine from the period of from the Hippocratic Hellenic period and pretty continuously throughout the medieval and early modern period. But you really start to see a bigger interest in it from the beginning, end of the 16th, early 17th century. So this is really where women's medicine begins to form, and the term gynecology appears in that moment as well. So at the beginning of the 18th century, there's already a very substantial medical interest in particular things that happen to women that don't happen to men. And so all of the questions about menstruation, pregnancy, lactation, childbearing, and menopause all start to be on the radar in a way that they had not been previously as matters of medical concern. But overwhelmingly, women's medicine up to the 18th century was very much concerned with the question of how to stop women dying in childbirth, which is an overwhelming problem of women's medicine. And that remained so through the 18th century. By the mid-19th, that's starting to shift. And there's, I guess, more space for doctors to be thinking about all the different kinds of things that might happen to women, not just the threat that they face in bearing children. But all of the life cycles of women, you might say, like all of these reproductive cycles of menstruation and the life changes, are viewed as moments where women are particularly vulnerable to disease. And you can see how you might come to that view if you're used to women dying in childbirth. So that idea kind of collides with another concept, which has also been hanging around for a while through the 17th and 18th centuries, the idea of climacteric moments. And so this is an idea that has its origins in medieval astrology, with inspiration from Ptolemy, so it has some ancient Greek roots as well. And it's the idea that the body turns over all its cells in seven-year cycles. And so at the end of every 7 years, we have this moment of vulnerability or crisis, but it's understood to be more or less positive. It's both a vulnerability and an opportunity. And if we can survive that crisis, we come out stronger and then are good for another 7 years. And so menopause is kind of assimilated to this idea as well. It's understood definitely certainly in the Montpellier tradition as being a kind of positive crisis that one can survive in order to become stronger.
And are we seeing something where like the changes, particularly in regards to reproductive processes for women, are just more noticeable? Or do they become pathologized? Because women are dying? Like, why the focus on women as apart from men?
Well, there is, particularly in France, I would say more than other cultures, somewhat of a fixation with the idea that men and women are radically different from one another. So the French in this period are very much seeing women as almost a different species. They're prepared to admit that they're human, but they really think that everything is completely differently wired and laid out, and they need an entirely separate field of medicine unto them. So I think that is very, very generative for the focus on all kinds of women's experiences and conditions. And when it's taken with the notion that there are both climacteric crises that occur in all bodies, and there are reproductive crises occurring for women because of their menstrual cycle and their childbearing and their menopause, right? So all of those things point toward the view that women maybe need more treatment than men. So that women are more medicalized, if you like, right? They are understood to require more doctor's appointments and more medications and more monitoring of their aging.
Yeah, okay. So women are just generally more pathologized in general.
But also more long-lived. So that's somewhat of an irony, because it's also in this moment they realize women are also the sex that are living longer. So this causes a little bit of a conflict in the medical literature, because when you think of being more prone to disease, you might think, well, you're also not going to live as long. And so previously the question of mortality and morbidity, being dying and being sick, they were understood to be more or less parallel. What we see at the end of the 18th century is they kind of split off directly as a result of doctors arguing about what it means that women are both more sick and live longer. And they realize, no, we need two concepts that are different from one another. They don't track together. And one is morbidity. And you can have that from the time of adolescence all through your lifespan. And this is what they think is the case for women. And mortality, which is just when it all ends. They think men are fine. They trundle along. They go through puberty without any problems. They age well. And then, boom, something takes them out. Women, they get to puberty. Everything falls to pieces. They drag themselves through their life. And it just goes on and on and on.
Right, because aging is more precarious, not simply like the end of it, but from the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. All of these stable stages for women are met with different, just frantic hysteria, right?
Yeah. And so you might say that menopause kind of emerges at the moment before aging itself was really thought about in the way that we do now. So that this is definitely one of the sources of debate among doctors. There'd be some who say, well, as soon as women cease to menstruate, they have all these problems. I know, because I've examined older women and they have, breast cancer and uterine cancer and cirrhosis of the liver and dementia. And so they can identify all these diseases of aging, but they attribute it to menstruation. They say, well, it's because she's not menstruating. You get other doctors saying, well, that just seems like they're getting older, right? I mean, that's happening to men as well. Men don't have menstruation, so maybe that's not menopause. And so this is, it becomes the ground for sorting out some of these questions about what are the pathologies of aging and which are specific to women and which are not.
Mm-hmm. So is there an idea then that, I mean, all the way around, I'm still just trying to wrap my head around how much women is there, like, what's the kind of, what is the actual axis? Is it about the aging? Is it about being a woman? What is it about this like very clear reproductive cycle? Kind of what is the crisis point for women?
Well, I mean, women were just thought to be always in crisis, right? So the idea that there is a menstrual cycle to doctors meant that women are not stable. They're constantly moving through these different crises of the lifespan. They are the sex that is in crisis. So if you understand crisis in a positive sense, in the way that you get through the Montpellier tradition, it's, you might think, well, maybe that's something magnificent about women, that they had these continual reinventions and opportunities to renew themselves. If you understand it more in the Paris view that emerges at the beginning of the 19th century, it's pretty bad. It just means you're sick all the time, right? So the crisis is a thing to be avoided.
You also get into in the book, in chapter 7, you start talking about psychiatry, mm-hmm. And erotomania and degeneration, and I found this also quite fascinating. I'd love, and our listeners would love to hear about that as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I thought, okay, so what is the relationship between menopause and hysteria? Hysteria is a really big topic in 19th century psychiatry. It's specific to women. It relates to the reproductive system. So I thought that's an interesting place to go looking, and quite surprised to find that actually most doctors didn't think older women were prone to hysteria. And I could have just put it to bed at that point and said, okay, I'm not going to pursue that any further. It's not a topic. But I noticed that they nonetheless did talk about menopause. And so I looked a bit more closely at what they were saying about it. And what they said is that women, as they get, hysteria is a disease of younger women when their uterus and reproductive organs are most active. And it deranges their brain. Older women don't have that problem because the uterus is now going into a sort of latency. But that transition toward its latency can also perturb their brains. And it does so in a very specific way by producing sexual perversions. So I thought, well, that's interesting. And so I started investigating a bit further. To what extent were people being diagnosed with this? Well, they were not only being diagnosed, they were being incarcerated. So I did track a few cases of women who were placed in asylums and kept there for many years on the grounds of inappropriate sexual behaviours. One woman liked to walk around her home naked, and her family found this intolerable. So she found herself in an asylum. Another woman had a penchant for seducing younger men of a working class background. And this was thought to be incredibly inappropriate as well. So there were all sorts of behaviours that were identified as representing this menopausal erotomania. And so the implications for those women were sometimes pretty drastic.
Yeah, definitely. And are we seeing a kind of a similar discussion of the lecherous old man? How do these things compare?
Well, people were worried about lecherous older men, but not as a whole big category of pathology. So you definitely find concerns about that in the psychiatric literature too. But there isn't a whole other literature that can be drawn upon in the way that there is for menopause. And so there's already a substantial body of medical writing identifying menopause as a kind of problem time. So the psychiatrist coming into that can say, well, okay, so we had this whole mechanical explanation and we have this whole, reinforced literature that supports our view that women should be treated for mental pathologies at the time of the cessation of menses.
Yeah, I'm getting this whole story of women just being, much more susceptible to the demands of their fickle bodies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, so women were, and in France, women were vastly more incarcerated in asylums than men in the mid-19th century. By the end of the 19th century, it was becoming clear that wasn't quite right, but in that middle period, it was very much the case that they were more targeted.
Yeah. What happens when female medical professionals start writing?
Yeah, so you start to see women entering medicine in France fairly early in the 19th century, but not necessarily as official doctors. So there were quite a few women now collaborating with doctors and effectively getting the same education, but not the qualification at the end of it and the entitlement to practice. They would nonetheless write about women's health as well, often in a very matter-of-fact way, but some of them took on all of the men's discourse. So all of the nailing out of menopause, if you like, was done by 19-year-old medical students at the universities. When women started to attend to it, they mostly dismissed a lot of the claims about it being a terrible time for women, but some of them got on that bandwagon and became, you know, proponents of that view as well. So I sort of looked both at medical writings by women on menopause, and I looked at also fictional and other kinds of writers who were considering women's aging to see whether menopause figured in their kind of perspective about it. And that was a really valuable exercise, because I think when you focus on a topic in the history of medicine, you see a lot of publications appearing. It's easy to think that this is really getting out there into society in a big way. At the end of the 19th century and early 20th century, there were still a lot of women who had passed through the period of what we would now consider to be menopause without really paying it attention of that kind, even though the concept was available and doctors were talking about it.
And then also women are starting to write kind of fiction about it by the beginning of the 20th century, yes?
Well, not really about it, but certainly having a concept of something that they are passing through in that time. So I think it's interesting to see all the different ways that it's possible to understand that transition if you don't use the concept of menopause, which I'd say none of them really did. So they had other ways of understanding it.
How else do you understand this period?
You have to read Colette, or I wouldn't recommend reading the Comtesse de Tramart. She's quite an odd individual. She was someone who liked to give advice to women in the apostolic tradition of I'm an aristocrat, so you should live like me. Mm-hmm. And so she offered a few different ways that women could negotiate their aging. She was particularly concerned that you not be flirtatious and try to make yourself pretty, because that would just be tragic. But she was also laying open the possibility of a life of piousness, or alternatively, a life of sexual perversion. So these were options that she considered valid.
It's an interesting picture we get of old age here. Yeah. I cannot get over being fascinated by the idea that there's menopause just looms so large in the modern mind, right? Mm-hmm. This moment of, that it's this transition that really symbolizes so much else about womanhood. And the idea that for most of human history, we weren't really, it wasn't even, you know, a thing, is really fascinating. And I just cannot, still having trouble as a trained historian, wrapping my brain around this change. Mm-hmm,
I guess it is really the emergence of a period in which people are going to doctors for stuff that is not life-threatening. So, I mean, that's a broad shift that's happening in industrialized Europe in this period, and maybe wasn't so much happening before. So the elites perhaps have always been open to treatments of different kinds. I did look in the aristocrats typically had a whole medical arsenal at home, and sometimes some of them would sort of catalogue it. So some of those catalogues are available, and you can see what sort of medications people kept in their home sort of chemistry kit. And there were a wide variety of things that people were giving themselves and taking for different ailments throughout the lifespan, as well as doing things like bloodletting. So that the bloodletting was a big treatment all through the early modern period. Everyone was doing bloodletting. It wasn't specific to any particular group, but it was thought in the 18th century to be an excellent treatment for aging of both sexes.
Yeah, and bloodletting and regularly, right? Mm-hmm. Regularly.
Oh, yeah, every day, yeah.
You know, like, you know, kind of like getting a facial or something. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Enemas too, enemas, very popular.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow, I find this work fascinating and I have enjoyed talking to you, but I've taken up tons of your time, so I'm just going to, one more question and we can go. So what are you working on right now? What's next?
Yeah, so a couple of things. I mean, so at the end of the book, in the last chapter of the book about menopause, I talk about the emergence of French gynecology and how women with fibroid tumors became a sort of one of the early targets for experimental hysterectomy. So that got me interested in the emergence of gynecology sort of from the perspective of its impact on patients. And there I began working on a project about that. And then because I like to read across different disciplines, I read some work in anthropology and in sociology on women's experiences of gynecological surgeries, and ended up actually collaborating with the scholars working in that area. So, so that's a project that I'm working on now. I'm also very interested in preventative health, right? So how we come to have this idea in the modern era that there are an array of knowledges and practices needed to preserve our bodies. And that was a big concern of the 19th century. And doctors writing about menopause had a long set of prescriptions for things that you could do to oneself, you know, to age better. And so that idea really began to globalize through the 20th century, at the same time as medicine stopped really worrying about it all that much. And as medicine became far more scientific and focused on clinical trials and specific medications and surgeries, the idea of that the individual should take responsibility for their health wasn't really of concern to doctors anymore. But we probably do more of it now than ever, right? I mean, there's so many products and practices that are being done all the time by ordinary people. So in a sense, we have medicalized to an enormous degree, self-medicalization.
Yeah, in-home self-medicalization, continual obsession with staying as young as possible for as long as we possibly can. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this. I would really like to write a history of self-medicalization.
Oh, yeah. And I'm interested. I'd like to think about, you know, self-care, like when, because there's a lot of, I'm thinking about, you know, like the sanitariums and stuff that you can see is like as what we could be characterized as self-care or working on yourself or something like that. It's an interesting kind of modern rebranding of an 18th, 19th century practice.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the idea has been around for a long time, but I think just the volume of it really begins to increase from the 19th century onwards.
Yeah, and I mean, how it's meant to be your job now is very interesting. Yeah, okay, I'm great, write it. I can't wait to read it. Just get on that. Obviously, it's a little harder to do than say, but great. Allison, thank you so much for getting up bright and early in Sydney to have this chat with me. And take care.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.